listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Sound Poetry. Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9 FM. I'm your host, David Gilmore. We have with us today a celebrity. You'll probably be aware of some of his works, if not the name itself, but we have with us Bob Pyle. Most of his works go under the author's name of Robert Michael Pyle, and they range over several genres. First is the scientific, for he is a lepidopterist, a butterfly man, of high regard with PhD and fellowship awards. Second, he's an author of naturalist writings, well-known prose works being Wintergreen, Where Bigfoot Walks, Crossing the Dark Divide. In fact, The Dark Divide is the name of a film that you might be able to see in the very near future. It has been produced and it's out there, of Bob's trip in the Dark Divide of the Columbia Gorge Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. There's also Sky Time in Grays River, I believe, a set of essays, and The Tangled Bank. Both of those, I think, are collections of essays, right? All right. He also has branched out into musical and poetical genres. He has a band, Butterfly Launches from Sparpole, and several books of poetry. Most recently published is a handsome, large format volume about life in his home locale in Wakiakum County, Southwest Washington. The Tidewater Reach, Field Guide to the Lower Columbia River in Poems and Pictures. The photographs in it are by Judy Vandermatten, a friend of Bob's from long time, which the photographs were chosen carefully, not to be accompaniments of the poems, but by themselves, interesting plates. And there are even some lovely woodcuts that separate the poetry groupings. It's published by Columbia River Reader Press. I urge you to look for this on the poetry shelf or on the recent publication shelf in bookstores. I've even read that Bob has been getting into the writing of novels, and some of those are in publication right now. So we're pleased to have with us Bob Pyle, writer, poet, and storyteller. He's going to read a number of narrative poems from the Tidewater Reach, which will tell of the lives of people of the river that he has known, and the life on the rivers themselves besides, with history to boot. Bob, glad you're here, and I'm looking forward to hearing as much poetry as you wish to read.
That's a dangerous proposition, David. Thank you so much. Thank you for the warm welcome and a very kind introduction. I'm so happy to be on Radio Tacoma and on Sound Poetry with David Gilmore, a program that I know has a warm and loyal following. And I'm honored to be among the fine list of poets with whom you've spoken and from whom you've heard in the past. So thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure.
I think I may begin with actually the first poem in the book, which goes back right to the roots of the Lower Columbia River and much of the Columbia River in Washington and Oregon as we know it today. The river, of course, has been a long time coming. Over many, many thousands of years. However, in the relatively recent past, that is to say the Pleistocene, a series of events occurred involving the melting of giant ice dams in a series of floods that were for a very long time and still are known as the Missoula floods. Glacial Lake Missoula was dammed up again and again by glaciers in different advances in the Pleistocene. From time to time, when the warming events occurred, the ice melted and great gobs of this water flew out. Now, this was a hypothetical scenario for a long time. When I was a minor in geology at the University of Washington in the 1960s, these floods were really hypothetical, as was continental drift, believe it or not. However, they were soon proven to have actually occurred, just as was thought by a great pioneer geologist by the name of J. Harlan Bretz. And he was something of an iconoclast in his time, and he harvested a lot of derision for his theories. But when they were finally shown to be true, the floods were renamed by many of those who speak of them as Bretz's floods. And so that is a great sweet justice in the end. Although when asked how he felt about that, he said, well, it didn't really matter so much because all the people he proved wrong were now dead. However, it does matter. And Chris Novoselic, my partner with Ray Prestigard in Butterfly Launches from Sparpole, and I wrote this, I think, wonderful song called Bretz's Flood. I speak the words rather than actually sing them. And although they're wonderful with his guitar accompaniment, I think they'll stand on their own as a narrative poem. But this is a narrative that, although it happens quite fast and catastrophically, remember it happened again and again. Bretz's Flood. It starts in the furnace of the core, rises through the mantle's crush, makes the crust, then breaks on through in Pluton's vents, volcanoes. Dike swarms leak across the land like Vaseline on hot skin, congeal in lava flows called Rosa, Elephant Gap, and Rattlesnake Ridge, Umatilla, Pomona, and Sela, flow, then freeze in lichen-daubed entablature and colonnade, all the way to the sea. After Pangaea, continents surfed the crusted waves, broke their backs against far shores, forging the shapes we know. Plates of the shelf, shoulder plates of the land, bunch them up in the middle, raise the Rockies from nothing more than force and dust. Where mountains crumple upward before crumbling down again, a moment comes when, high enough, they tempt the snows that crown the years, then press and press and press some more till glaciers start to move. As cold goes south, the ice sheets grow till half the continent goes under. Polish, scour, lathe and grind, leave sign of ice on granite domes, the scream of ice on unforgetting stone. Rivers drain the glaciers, but Clark Fork is plugged. 2,000 feet of ancient ice, 200 miles of inland sea. Then warming and melting, time after time for 1,000 years, till the dam breaks through. Then glacial Lake Missoula is loosed upon the land. Down pours deluge, downhill, down grade, down map, 10 times the flow of all the rivers in the world. Cut the coulees, channel scablands, carve basalt like old black butter, even gouge that great green slot that we will call the gorge. Slash Grand Coulee, swamp Dry Falls, shoot Wallula Gap, whack Beacon Rock, shatter the very bridge of the gods before they're even named. Never so much water, sluicing to the sea with such a force of will. Sloshing from wall to black rock wall, from rim rock to rim rock, 400 feet deep. Until the ice all gone, the river finds its level, never looking back at the havoc it's left behind, where all that remains is geology.
Few will ever hear perhaps a geological poem of such importance in the Northwest.
Well, when Chris and I were working on our album, you know, he's primarily known for his work as a co-founder and the bassist for Nirvana, but he's a wonderful acoustic guitarist too, produces beautiful songs. And the first song we did was rich in natural history from all over the world. And so for when we decided to do another one and later an album, he said he'd been doing his degree online at WSU because, you know, the lads in Nirvana never really had time to go to college. So he did it later. And he loved his geology class. And he said, write me a geology poem. So I did. And it ends up all that's left is geology.
And people can hear that on YouTube if they search for that.
They can indeed. And they can also find the album LP vinyl or CD on all the streaming services by going to the website butterflylaunch.com. And while I'm at it, David, allow me to say the website for the Columbia River Reader Press, who published the book we're reading from tonight. Sure. But that's a simple website too. CRReader, one word, CRReader.com. And that will show you, if you can't find the book elsewhere, that'll show you how to get it.
Very good. Now, I would like you to perhaps read in sequence then some narrative poems, like a long river of poems.
I shall do exactly
with a break in between so that people can know the distinction there. But it's probably going to be obvious. So.
Nicely stated, a river of poems. Mm-hmm. The first one is one of those sweet moments that we shall always remember. It's called Cottonwoods in March, Willow Grove. After the dance, you drove out Willow Grove across the bridge beyond the town, between river and backwater slough. The warm night beguiled by cottonwoods all along the bank, just breaking bud, just putting out their soft green tongues, all sticky with the brown paste of balsam, once called balm of Gilead. Both of you taken by the cloying scent, far beyond sense. You knew you shouldn't park, but you did, and stroked each other's faces with the soft green spears, cheeks, eyelids, right below the greedy nostrils, lips, lacerating your hearts beyond repair. A pleasure so intense, the two senses least used, smell and touch, that you could never, ever speak it as it was. Barely even kissed. But you both knew, didn't you, that the kisses would come, and you could only hope they would match the sweetness of those cottonwood strokes on Willow Grove that night. Everything I write addresses and celebrates the other lives besides the humans. We're very much a part of the larger picture of nature. We are, and people will always be part of my writing and thinking and loving, but also the other kinds of animals and plants with whom we share the world. This one is called Lesser Lives. Mostly, we tend to think of the big lives on the river, the ospreys and eagles, salmon and sturgeon, seals and sea lions and otters and all of their ilk. But underlying, undergirding, underwriting, all those grandees are the lesser lives, at least in matters of size. The fry and the copepods, the worms and the gastropods, all the large legions of invertebrates whose mass far exceeds that of all the migratory whales. The surprise is how many of these little creatures are no more native in these waters than the Chinese cannery workers, Finnish loggers, or the name Columbia itself. Whether riding Japanese tsunami or some flag's ballast, they hail from elsewhere, just as most of us surely do. Have you seen the yellow mayflies, big as grasshoppers and sometimes as thick as locusts? Noted the serried drifts of shiny olive clamshells on some wake-whacked beach? Who knows whose bilge they came in on? But someone eats them all in this great flowing chowder, this soup bowl of a river, where we are the least life of all in the long run. I wrote a number of poems based on visits to pubs along the river. Perhaps not surprisingly, as poets and pubs are often one. Writing this book was almost a year's writing residence for me, and the residency was held along the Columbia River.
Is this where you sharpened your bard's tongue?
Well, I hope so. Although, if too many jars were tilted at the pubs, then, of course, the opposite occurred. I'm going to share two different of the River Pub poems. The first one is called River Pubs, and funny you should mention the bard, because this one is called Desdemona Club, A Gray Day on Grays Bay. A couple little head notes for this. First of all, this is in Astoria, and the pub referred to is the Desdemona Club. It's also known as the Dirty D. It's out at the dark side of Astoria. What there is of it, there's not much of it. And also to be known is that the sands heading out to the dangerous Columbia River Bar, the sands that have claimed many ships, are also known as Desdemona, the Desdemona Sands, from which no doubt the pub takes its name. And the poem refers to the unlucky chick in Othello. Well, that's Desdemona as well, of course. River pubs, Desdemona Club, A Gray Day on Grays Bay. Or it would be, if you could see it. There's no river view from the Dirty D, in spite of its famous portholes. There's also no well scotch for happy hour, only bourbon, American whiskey. The only scotch at all is Johnny Black at $6.50 per. This in a town founded by Scots. But the shuffleboard in the back is free. Nirvana's on the air. And I am almost alone on a Monday afternoon in March. One or two at the bar to keep the pink-haired barmaid company. A couple more clinging to the video poker. But if you could see out and through the shot streaming rain, and if you happen to look north across the river, it would be a very gray day on Grays Bay. Put out into that murk, turn left like a bar pilot, and with luck you'll come to the bridge. Beyond lie the Desdemona Sands, where as many ill-starred seamen have come to grief as have belly up to the bar at the Dirty D. This dive, also named for the unlucky chicken Othello, here at the dark end of town. Just think, had it been a gray day on Grays Bay on May 11th, 1792, when Robert Gray crossed the bar in the Columbia Rediviva, there would be no Grays Bay. The Columbia might be named Vancouver's River, and the well whiskey at the Dirty D, it would be Canadian. If you head upriver away, all the way to Kalama, you will come to another pub. It's a big McMenamin's pub with a Hawaiian theme. But it has a satellite tiny pub, a sort of a snug, in a little log cabin up the river walk a little bit from the main establishment. And it is called All's Cabin. So I'd like to read one called River Pubs, All's Cabin, subtitled There Will Be Grebes. Tiny log built inn perched between railroad and river in Kalama. Grateful Dead, mellow on Pandora, black Cabernet, yellow lights, no one loud as they bend their elbows, trading stories of the Amalfi Coast. We got the ferry to Capri. Oh, we did that too. Almost have the place to myself, as it never will be in summer. But now, Cottonwood's finally bare. It won't be long until they push browny green buds out their tips. Already 11 days into the year, hazel catkins dangle and hazen the bank bright yellow, first flower of spring. Swarm flies glitter and dance off the deck. I know you rider gonna miss me when I'm gone, croon the dead. We can share the women, we can share the wine. When the wine's all gone, it's back along the beach, late January sun. Once the butterfly fleet fluttered here. Now only a minor tug, barge of unknown burden, makes a little wake. Nothing else disturbs the river, except every flash and ripple ever made. And you just know that if you look long enough, there will be grebes. I'd like to go all the way down to the mouth of the river now for a little love song called I Cover the Waterfront. Iwako, December 2018, for Carla. Sometimes it seems the hopes of all mankind lie on display in a small town bookstore, against all odds, still open on a bleak December dock, in a time when so much else is gone. After the reading, I spill out the back door onto the wet green waterfront, walk up and down in the dripping dusk. The slips still have boats, though the fleet is tiny now. Still, a good seafood grill, a pub, and Jesse's fish market at the end of the pier persist. I remember charters by the dozen, the cafe at the end of the spit, Dupay's hardware as a going concern. But now it's mostly a matter of the riverfront, where the Columbia brushes Baker Bay before dying or being born anew into the ocean itself. And what moves me is not what's gone, but what somehow remains. The boats, the oysters, the books shiny in the light through the wet window. They speak to the possibility of all things, even in these times, waterfronts do. As long as little seaside towns live on, giving harbor to half-forgotten craft and vagabonds on a winter's night, I will continue to cover the waterfront, seeking something not likely to be found anywhere else.
A certain nostalgia in some of your poems for things that are vanishing, that are holding on but nearly gone.
Yes, it's difficult not to be elegiacal in this day and age, perhaps any day and age as a poet, because, of course, things come and go and we miss them when they go. But I'm not content to merely write elegies and songs of loss.
Lugubrious songs.
Lugubrious.
No.
Thank you.
You definitely have written some jubilant pieces, too.
Well, jubilation is important. I love Patti Smith, the songwriter and great poet, wonderful poet of New York City, Patti Smith. And I love her album and her song called Jubilee. And life should be for all we're losing and all we will lose, and all that must be recognized and, yes, lamented and fought for to keep what we can. Nonetheless, we must be jubilant as well. So here's a jubilant poem, and sticking with the theme of books from the last one. I like a narrative poem, as you said, Dave. I like it to tell stories. And I think people like to hear stories. This one's pure story. In fact, my full intention was to write this story as a novel. And having published novels, I know how much work that is and how much time it takes. And I love it. It's fun. But I decided that probably wasn't going to happen with this. So let's write a narrative poem instead. And it was lots of fun to do. I hope people will enjoy coming on this little cruise with me.
Let's do it.
It's called The Book Boat. He bought a good old tub named Lorraine off an old salt gone to shore on Sylvie Island. Barely knew navigation, let alone diesel. So, come spring and still afloat, he found a mate, a worse-off soak, never dried out, in a tavern off Lower Burnside on Water Street. To caulk decks, pump bilge, romance the fickle engine to life. When it began to look like Lorraine might not sink, he built shelves in the hold and started buying books wherever he could. Goodwills and thrifts in the Dalles and St. Helens, library sales in Rainier and White Salmon, the remainder tables at Powell's. And then, recalling bookmobiles from his boyhood on the plains, he hung his shingle on the bridge and took the book boat on the road, on the river. And so it went, up and down the tidal reach, Bonneville to Baker Bay, and back again, sometimes through the locks, all the way to Lewiston, laying his wares before the boaters, the fishers, the workers, the loafers, all of them hungry for good books, though they might not know it. He sold them cheap, gave them away, or, his favorite, bartered for fish, fruit, or laundry. Swapped a late Brian Doyle for a sturgeon. Middlemarch for Maryhill wine. Made enough for ground beef, beer, and diesel. Even the cat got fed, and the mate paid enough for drunken leave ashore. Lorraine became a legend up and down the river. Marinas vied for her, gave free moorage for a night or three, until he started to wonder about the islands, the inside passage, and beyond. So he took Lorraine across the bar, and he didn't die. Put in at La Push, where he sold all of his Pushkin to a Russian emigre, and a set of Twilight to a wannabe werewolf, and then east up the Straits, Nia Bay, CQ, PA, PT, and points north. Last rumors came from Kodiak. But even now the Columbia remembers, and there's always a slip open, just in case.
Well, your novel could have been a travelogue detailing lots of ports and actions in ports with people that came to visit. I mean, it really could have been a social travelogue.
It absolutely could. Really, I was first put in the mind of such a thing by a wonderful classic novel from the 19th century called The Parnassus on Wheels. And Parnassus was the name that a man gave to his van, he called it. It was a wagon, like a gypsy wagon, in which he traveled around New England and sold books from village to village. The book's by Christopher Morley, a great read, wonderful read. I'd like to read one called River Walks. It touches upon many a town along rivers all around the world. River walks are the same everywhere, except how they're not. One shoreline promenade is a lot like another, tugging the body along the waterline, a chance to move the muscles, to dampen the mind and its muddles, in the generous lap of wake and wind and wonder. And there is company if desired. Is it white pelicans and egrets with plumes, like a high cirrus cloud in high winds on a Mexican lakeside Malecon? Or magpies and kingfishers of a mid-continent canyon? Or the sea lions and sea otters and herons haunting Monterey docks or northern riversides near their sea dumps? Rafts of western grebes, cottonwoods or palms, willows, alders, or mimosas? And always and everywhere, dogs, lots of dogs. For towns that haven't yet sacrificed their shorelines to industry, riprap, or roadways, or have grabbed them back again, there is something about a river walk they will never regret, for which the citizens will always thank them. Call it a grace note on existence. Call it wet. Call it a chance to step back and consider where to stand now at the moist edge where we once stepped out.
You did write about yourself as being a person of the edge. You've enjoyed living on the edge.
I think that's right. And the river brings us to the edge of the continent, quite literally. In fact, here's the spot that's the very, very edge of Waukegan County. It's down where the Grays River and the Deep River, that my friend Chris and I respectively live along, and there's another poem in here about that called Two Rivers Song that we do, where those two rivers come together in Grays Bay, named for the same Robert Gray who made us American and not Canadian, where Grays Bay comes together with the Columbia River. And right there's a point of land called Altoona. It was an old salmon cannery, now just a ghost town. That's right on the edge, right in the edge of where I live. It's called Spring Comes to Altoona. This is the one when we head out Altoona Road every year. A bright sunny day at spring's front door. Could be as early as February, as late as April. It'll likely be nippy or maybe hot by the water, sparkling like so many stars all set on strobe. Rafts of scops all splash, one for every spark. This is the sharp corner where Deep River and Grays River step into the Great River together, making Grays Bay, making the Columbia 9 miles wide. You can just make out the bridge, and in a few months, the fireworks will piffle downriver over Astoria. But this is the one when fireworks come as indecent, cerise explosions of blood current, in the gorgets of attending hummingbirds, in the unbearably blue wings of echo azures, first on the wing. Altoona faces due southwest, catches the sun full face as soon as it tips this way. This is the reason for this annual escapade among the ivy-hung cliffs of basalt, the other cliffs of mineral mud where bandtails come to lick, in shadows of broken stacks from pillar rock all the way down to here. Spring comes first to Altoona. Everyone knows that. This is the one when we come to pay our vernal tribute.
Yes, it is important, I think, to pay attention to all these creatures that you are able to name, which have themselves poetic sounds. What is a scop?
A scop is a diving duck related to the bufflehead or the tufted duck that you might know from the UK. Mm-hmm. It's basically black and white. You look out on the river and you see these great rafts of piebald sea ducks, and they're black and white, and they're often diving, and they love gathering together in big numbers in the water.
Thank you so much for coming. This is Radio Tacoma. I've been your host on Sound Poetry, and we have had the pleasure to be regaled with the riverine poetry of Robert Michael Pyle, better known as Bob Pyle when you get to know. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, David, and you just used one of my favorite words, riverine.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.